Welcome to Archive Treasures. I'm Rosie Hill from the Trentham and District Historical Society. Each episode, we will explore a topic ranging from Irish migration in the 19th century to plane spotting at Crannies Hill in World War II. Hidden Histories, The Rainbow Connection. I decided to make this podcast for several reasons. The obvious one was being to coincide with Pride Month this year. Another was an increasing awareness that, as a history group, we were potentially missing elements of the area's history. That is, history that in the past, and even now, may still make some people uncomfortable. This needn't be the case. In a recent ABC article about oral histories being recorded by the State Library of WA, Director of Library Services, Susan McEwen, is quoted as saying, "The project was part of a broader strategy designed to diversify the library's collection from the past 130 years. Historically, our collection can be of a colonial nature," Ms. McEwen said. "Last year, we released a new collection strategy, which is a real focus on everyone's story being important," she said. "Making sure that we collect the full gamut of what it is to be Western Australian, and especially looking at historically underrepresented communities." When I first floated the idea for this episode back in 2022, I had a discussion with others and received a nervous response. To be fair, I probably didn't explain it very well, as it was just a vague concept at the time, no more than a thought bubble, a notion still to be fully grasped. At the time, a regular feature of our Facebook postings had been short biographies of earlier residents. The posts included those who had made a name for themselves for running a business, through their philanthropic endeavours, or just characters from whose lives it was easy to spin a good yarn. With a gaydar sensitivity, however, I could see that a few of these could have fitted into the hidden in plain sight category. That is, people who didn't fit the heteronormative assumptions, but for whom no reference to any other lifestyle or significant relationships were recorded. Mentioning this drew a nervous reaction. As I said, I probably didn't explain it very well. So, to clarify here, my intention was not, and never has been, to point the finger or to out people. Also, I'm talking in past terms of what other lives may have been. In the book, A History of LGBTIQ Plus Victoria and 100 Places and Objects, one section states that things have not always been the way they are now, and we should not impose the lens of the modern day on our reading of the past. It goes on. If they focus too intensely on the sexual, the unremarkable daily lives of same-sex attracted people can be overlooked. So I'm not talking about lycra-clad figures dancing on floats covered in rainbow boas. That is a very recent form of celebration. The rainbow flag was only debuted at the Gay Freedom Day Parade in San Francisco in 1978, practically yesterday. Prior to that, the pink triangle was used as an identifying symbol, a pink triangle on a background. This was adapted from the badge that gay prisoners were forced to wear in Nazi concentration camps. Interestingly, in the Sydney Gay Mardi Gras this year, the 78ers float was bedecked with pink triangles. This was acknowledgement of the very different times of protest past, fighting for the dignity to be themselves, ourselves. From these beginnings, the current celebrations have evolved and continue to evolve, with the progress flag soon to overtake the rainbow version. But I digress. Back to local history. What I did think could be improved was to be more open when looking into the history of the people of the area. Not to assume, because we are in a rural area, that the heteronormative was all-encompassing. To realise that there would have been those who didn't fit into this category and may have been living a non-conforming life within the social norms of the time. Our colonial history goes well back, even prior to the gazetting of Trentham in 1863. As well as being populated from convicts deported to the colonies, Australia was populated by another type of regular arrival, those termed remittance men. These were often second or third sons of well-to-do English families sent out to the colonies. In her dissertation on these immigrants, Helen Leggett describes them. Historically, the term remittance men referred to a gentleman immigrant exiled to a British colony by their wealthy British family, supported with regular remittances of money. She goes on to clarify, a remittance man is an immigrant who lives abroad, specifically one considered undesirable at home. At an 1888 meeting in Melbourne, the secretary of the Charity Organisation Society bemoaned the practice of sending to Australia men he described as the moral refuse of Great Britain and Ireland. One example Helen Leggett gives is of William Montague Davenport Howes. We read the following. In 1912, he was sentenced to 7 years hard labour for indecent assault on a male. At his hearing, William's defence referred to him as a sort of remittance man who, at times, gave way to drink. In 1919, he was again arrested for indecent assault on a male and given a 10-year jail sentence. William's indecent offending later in life may be indicative of behaviour that would cause damage to his family's reputation had it been discovered during his life in Britain. Described in the terminology of the time, this could now just as easily be read as, embarrassed to have a gay son, the family sent him packing to the other side of the world with a small income to live on. Once there, he continued to be punished for his way of life. One thing to bear in mind when looking at this past history is the changing language or terms used, mainly in legal proceedings, to describe those who we may today identify as belonging to the rainbow community. Many of these terms were quite derogatory, or at least had overtones of such when used in this context. Invert, homosexualist, thanks Quentin Crisp, sapphist, faggot, molly, fairy, Nancy boy, a friend of Dorothy, or a pansy. Nice flower. Fast forward a few decades, and we can look to research focusing on evidence of gay men in Melbourne at the time. The title of this is Camp Melbourne in the 1920s and 30s, Trade, Queens and Inverts by Wayne Murdoch. In telling the story of homosexual Melbourne between the wars, a couple of things have to be remembered. Firstly, the period is now outside the range of living memory. No one who was active on the scene in the 1920s and 30s is still alive, and very few records actually produced by homosexual men have survived. Much of the material which a historian usually relies on, such as letters, diaries, photographs, and memoirs, just doesn't exist. As members of a criminalised group, homosexual men tended not to keep anything which might incriminate them or be used as legal evidence. In fact, some of the few remaining love letters between two men that I've been able to find are in the evidence files of the Crown Prosecutor at the Prov. Even an address book could be used to track down and prosecute your friends and acquaintances. Any letters, diaries, and photos that a man might have kept were often destroyed on his death by family members and friends who were keen to straighten up the record and preserve reputations. Wayne goes on. This being the case, I've had to draw on other sources of information, including memoirs which mention homosexual men, transcripts of a few recorded interviews, part of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives collection of oral history interviews recorded in the 1980s and 90s, newspaper reportage, and here a vote of thanks has to be made to the National Library of Australia for wonderful resource that is Trove, and records of criminal prosecutions held at the Public Records Office of Victoria, PROV. Much of the material is scrappy and incomplete. Much of it is written from the point of view of the dominant society and, in the case of newspapers and the records of the Victoria Police and the court system, is actively hostile. But there is information. Gaining any insight from it often requires a diligent reading between the lines of the records of the dominant society. A skill that I think homosexual people have long been versed in. Gender is another area that would have undergone an even more extreme whitewash. A notable exception is the story originating from Bendigo of Edward de Lacey Evans, previously known as Alan Tremaine. In the La Trobe Journal, No. 69, from autumn 2002, published by the State Library of Victoria Foundation, an article by Mimi Collagen documents the story. Here are some snippets from that telling. In September 1879, it was revealed in the Bendigo newspapers that Edward de Lacey Evans, champion ploughman, mining captain, married man and father, was really a woman. From Kilkenny originally, while immigrating, de Lacey met a fellow immigree, Mary Delahunty, and they were married at St Francis Roman Catholic Church in Lonsdale Street, Melbourne. The article states that there is evidence that they did not live comfortably together. Delahunty opened a school in Blackwood and around 1862 left to marry Lyman Oatman Hart, an American mining surveyor in Dalesford. Incidentally, Lyman became mayor of Dalesford in 1878. During the next 20 years, Evans married two other women, Sarah Moore, who died of pulmonary tuberculosis in 1867, and Julia McCard of Bendigo. Evans worked as a carter, miner, blacksmith and ploughman in the Blackwood, Bendigo and Stawell districts. Also mentioned in the article is a reference to a mention in Joseph Furphy's writings in the novel Such is Life. Joseph Furphy's character, Tom Collins, refers to one of those de Lacey Evanses we often read of in novels, as a generic term for a cross-dressing woman. Written in the 1890s, Furphy would have been familiar with the 1879 Evans case from its wide press coverage. An offshoot of the planning of this episode has been to start another podcast series with local Mel Thomas from Chaplin's Cafe. The series is called Hidden in Plain Sight. Our aim is to capture the stories of the rainbow community in the Hepburn Shire, collecting oral histories from a community that has historically been excluded. You are invited to listen to these stories, and a link will be provided in the notes to point you in the right direction. Our first interview was with Max, who lived through the horrors and early years of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. Remembering that homosexuality had barely been decriminalised at that time, and not in all states, this is a little of what Max had to say.
Whether it was because of the love of their friends and family around them, that was the other thing. A lot of families
ostracised.
And a lot of the people who contacted AIDS were, there was quite a few transsexual people, and of course that was an absolutely disaster because, you know, no one wanted the no family wanted someone else to know that their child was transsexual and, you know, and would not...
on top of that.
That's right, yeah. Would not accept the new name.
Person.
So the new person was just ostracised and back to the original person. So there was a lot of death notices that never went in papers. There was a lot of death notices went in under the original name, birth name, instead of the name that the person was living under at that stage. Mm. So it was all a hideous, hideous time. And I think I said in the first interview, you know, we went to 21 funerals in a week.
Yeah.
Whoa. Which was absolutely phenomenal. And all these people had died of AIDS and HIV. A lot of families didn't turn up at the funerals. There was no markings on the grave to say, oh, you know, there was a marking on the grave to say so-and-so lies here, but no family recognition whatsoever because someone from the church could have gone down there and might know. Yeah. So it was really revolting. Yeah. Really was revolting. And it was a hard time to live through.
Yeah.
So that brings me back to Trentham and how to look into the past when so much effort has been made to hide this history. Harking back to Wayne Murdoch's comments, I decided to look at the local cemetery records, taking into account all we know about this history being hidden. In the archives there was a folder, Cemetery Records, Folder 591, Volume 1. The first set of records recorded the details listed on the headstones. Trentham Headstones listing. This covered the period 1870 to 1994. Once potential records had been selected, these were then cross-referenced with the second set of records from the Trentham Cemetery Trust, burial records. In these, other information was often noted, sometimes formally, often handwritten additions. The extra information was mainly employment for men and wife of notation for women. And just one instance was a husband of notation recorded. Additionally, other mentions were made such as Mrs. as well as child of. In setting about this analysis, and in an abundance of caution, I set a few parameters up front. 1. Records selected were those with no obvious sign of a married or, in more recent times, opposite-sex partner. 2. Only those records where an adult, 30-plus, met the above criteria were included. 3. Single graves where the age of the occupant is unable to be established have been excluded. 4. Those lost at war have also been excluded. Not because they didn't fit the criteria, but years of war may have impacted the opportunity to marry. 5. Single parents with children have also been excluded. Once again, not because they didn't fit the criteria, but as a conservative approach towards analysis, even though we know it is quite common, especially for women, to have children from an earlier relationship. 6. Where no relationship has been specified, if one person of each gender listed with differing surnames, they were deemed a cohabiting couple. 7. Once a short list of well over 100 had been established, these graves were visited to check if space had been left for a future spouse or partner to be added. A few more records were excluded on this basis. 8. As it was the custom for many generations, for the last single daughter to remain at home to care for elderly parents, regardless if this was convenient arrangement to her or not, a cut across the remaining female list of 80% seemed judicious. This also allowed for those with a religious vocation or who would not marry for other numerous reasons. This would still leave around 6 potential inclusions. 9. Men didn't have the same type of familial obligations, but may have been working away from their home, family, and intended. Restricting the cut to be those above 30 years of age partially allows for this, but once again, in an abundance of caution, and to allow for religious vocation or a myriad of other reasons, an 80% cut across the shortlist still gives 10 potential inclusions. Having got to the much abridged shortlist, I decided to go through the wording on the headstones. Many leave no clues to the relationships important to the deceased. Others may state their place in the family, son or daughter of, sister or brother of, aunt or uncle of. There are three listings, though, that appear to incorporate a special relationship between two non-related members of the same gender who have been buried together. These would require further research to determine the connection. They may be explained by being stepbrothers or stepsisters, or they may not. However, as previously mentioned, the purpose of the study is not to out anybody or cast what could be deemed the finger of suspicion on any person or family, but rather to share a way of looking and to think about how to remove the heteronormative wash when searching through historical records. As both Max Primmer and Wayne Murdoch have stated, it was common practice up until very recent times for the legal next of kin, perhaps an estranged or disapproving family member, not to acknowledge the adult version of the family member, albeit with regards to gender or personal relationships. In these days of marriage equality and other equalising social norms, it is very easy to forget how recently this was accepted. In my own case, with the untimely death of my first partner in 1988, even though we had been cohabiting for some years, living in a home we had purchased together, with planning well underway to start a family, I was still at the mercy of her family when she died, who, due to the prevailing laws of the time, were deemed her legal next of kin. I actually considered myself very lucky that they recognised our relationship and I was consulted in all decisions. I was also mentioned on the headstone as treasured partner, albeit after her parents and siblings were listed above. I could just as easily have been erased completely from her history. I spoke to many over the preceding years who, in a similar situation, had not been so well treated, even to the point of being totally excluded from the proceedings. I considered myself very fortunate. But, just for a minute, contrast this with the situation if we had been in a heterosexual relationship, or what expectations would be now. I am only talking just over 30 years ago. Decriminalisation of homosexuality only occurred for most states in around the 1980s. With South Australia starting the charge on the 17th of September 1975 and Tasmania not joining the fold until the 1st of May 1997, a full 22 years after South Australia, and then the law passing by only one vote. Decriminalisation was just the beginning, though. You only need to look at the struggles to get that far to realise public opinion still had a long way to go to achieve acceptance of difference. The marriage equality debate and plebiscite result of recent times highlights a shift in the general population towards a fairer and more inclusive ethos. There is still, and I suspect will long be, a resistance to a fully equal society with regards to many human characteristics. But progress is being made, and events like the marriage equality vote give us all hope. Back to the snapshot of Trentham Cemetery records. Given the pointers, for those that may, in the modern vernacular, have been members of the rainbow community, where does that leave us? Think about your own family history, especially in generations past. Are there unmarried aunts or uncles, perhaps estranged or otherwise not in regular contact? Could any of these have been hiding their true selves, living a life not fully approved of? Was there someone special in their life, perhaps known as their special friend, their mate, or their companion? Something to ponder. When Vicky Steggall spoke recently about writing your family history, she said, when people talk to us, they will often tell us something that is just 10% away from what they actually meant. What is really going on here is a really good question. What did they say? What did they mean? Two different things. Vicky goes on to say, always read your sources carefully. Some people leave behind diaries and letters, if you are really lucky. Look for what they don't say. She tells the story of reading a woman's diary, where there is a notation of a town name with no other details. She is trying to tell herself something, but hide it at the same time. In that instance, it turns out to be a sister in an asylum for 17 years. Another instance is the notation of a single capitalised letter, the letter P. This was something the person wanted to remember, but they were a bit coy about, which turned out to be a love story on the eve of World War I. So they tell you things, but they are also keeping it quiet. You may also look for the rainbow connection, which once again may be hidden in plain sight. A possible example of this 10% adage can be found in a book of private letters edited by Mandy Kirby. The book flap describes the contents. From the private papers of Winston Churchill to the tender notes of an unknown Tommy in the trenches, Love Letters of the Great War brings together some of the most romantic correspondence ever written. Within the contents, most letters are clear about from whom and to whom they are sent. Primarily, men to their wives or fiancés, occasionally the other way. In two instances, letters from men are only addressed to their sweethearts. The first of these, while not mentioning the recipient's name, potentially indicates that it is addressed to someone of the opposite sex. The second of these continually avoids any reference that could be seen to indicate either gender. In another entry titled An Anonymous Woman to Private George B, the last page of the letter was missing, so no signature is available, hence Anonymous Woman. The editor has assumed the sender was female. Reading the letter, however, the style and tone, it is very easy to hear this in a male voice. Also, the circumstances surrounding the letter say it was sent sometime after George died. The family were unaware of any special relationship and had no idea who the sender may have been. The contents indicate the sender had not been privy to where to send letters to George, and obviously was not known to his family, and sadly had not been made aware of his death. Is this mystery connection our 10%? As I said earlier, the purpose of this episode is not to point the finger or to out your great Auntie Betsy, favourite Uncle Tommy, or Cousin George. Their stories are not mine to tell. Rather, this is to share a way of looking at what historically was not recognised, what was shunned by families, individuals whose lives were not fully acknowledged, whose true selves may have been concealed, those who were hidden in plain sight, those who may yet make up our hidden history, if you like, our rainbow connection. Archive Treasures is produced on Dja Dja Wurrung country. We acknowledge and pay respects to the traditional owners, and we would also like to extend our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. Archive Treasures is brought to you by the Trentham and District Historical Society. If you would like to hear further episodes, they are available from most podcasting apps or on our website, www.trenthamhistoricalsociety.org.au, or you can go to our Facebook page, Trentham and Districts Historical Society, Australia. I hope you can tune in next time for more Archive Treasures.